Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Will McCants, a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy and director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. He is also an adjunct faculty member at Johns Hopkins University, and he is the author of the new book, The ISIS Apocalypse: The History, Strategy, and Doomsday Vision of the Islamic State.
In this show, we talked about the history of jihadi governance based off of a chapter from his new book, in particular, looking at the different cases from the Islamic State of Iraq to al-Shabaab to AQAP to AQIM to Jabhat al-Nusra and finally the Islamic State.
Before the interview, we're going to have a new primary sources section covering postings and releases from August 14th through September 19th. And then after the interview, we'll have our hashtag social media segment covering social media posts from October 7th through the 13th. Also want to thank the people who have signed up to support us on Patreon. If you're a fan of the podcast and would like to help support us with a small donation, you can visit the Patreon link that's in the show notes. In this episode's primary sources segment, we're going to be covering releases from August the 14th through September the 19th, catching up on some releases over the summertime that we haven't covered. And so, Aaron, let's start out with IS governance and administration releases.
During that time span, they put out a number of videos about this issue. The first one was on August 15th, when they discussed a bakery and the ovens for making a flatbread in Wilayat Raqqa, and for them highlighting how they're making sure that this whole production was running smoothly so that people could eat the bread within the territory they controlled there. Then about 2 weeks later, on August 30th, the Islamic State put out a video related to the traffic police in Wilayat Nineveh in Iraq, and highlighted how the traffic department was divided into two sections, with the first being the civil department, which deals with relieving congestion and monitoring traffic violations, and also highlighting how it's removed all the roadblocks that were previously in place. The second section within this was the technical department, and this is responsible for registering vehicles, overseeing the buying and selling of cars and motorbikes, and handling complaints. Another thing that they mentioned too related to this is that the Islamic State collects fees from those wishing to register vehicles that they enter into their database, highlighting another way of them making money to run their state. On the same day in Wilayat al-Jazeera, not necessarily specific to governance and administration, but just something interesting in of itself, they're highlighting the Abu Issa training camp and mentioning the different tasks during a regular type of day that somebody would go through. So, for example, they'd wake up at 5 a.m. for training. That would be followed by breakfast. Then they'd have classes in Sharia and then military tactics. Then they would have prayers and physical training after that, and then continue on throughout the day. Then a couple of days later, on September 2nd, the Islamic State's Wilayat Hama released another thing related to the bread ovens in that particular area, and highlighting how they're trying to guarantee enough supplies of flour and other ingredients so that they can continue these operations. And because of this, they've been able to secure the bread supply to 90% of the population of the province, allegedly. About a week after that, on September 8th, the Islamic State put out a video in Wilayat Nineveh. And part of it was talking about the construction work in the Islamic State and highlighting the different public services in the particular province, whether it was the electricity, water, and the regulating of markets. Then one of the IS engineers describes the various construction projects, including a food market, a market for women, the building of the Abu Umar al-Baghdadi Mosque. And then there is another segment in it about the highway maintenance and the electrical repairs that they're conducting. A couple of days later, on September 10th, they put out a video on Wilayat Al Jazeera, which spans the Syrian and Iraqi borders, looking at the agricultural system that they're running there, and highlighting that after they took over these areas, they began distributing agricultural tools, planting crops, so as to encourage different farmers to continue their work. And according to them, this has allegedly ended poverty and increased the agricultural output. And then finally, the individual on this video describes how the grain is graded, weighed, and distributed. And then finally, amongst a section of videos from the Islamic State, on September 13th, they put out another release from Wilayat Nineveh, talking with a Hizbah official and explaining their consumer protection work, highlighting an inspection of food at shops for hygiene and public health standards, and checking that products are being weighed correctly in markets, and then noting that they're especially concerned with checking the expiration dates on products in shops, and if there are any you know, issues with this, that they'll give out fines and destroy any spoiled goods as punishment.
And can you tell us about the Islamic State's gold dinar videos that were released in early September?
Yeah, so one of the biggest media campaigns that the Islamic State conducted during this time span was when they put out 11 different videos related to the release of their gold dinar between September 2nd and 13th. So, for example, they put out a video on the 2nd from Wilayat Furat showing footage of gold coins being minted, and highlighting that this will help the Islamic State defeat the infidels, not just militarily, but also economically, and freeing themselves of the dollar and the economic structures of the infidels and tyrants. On the same day, they put out something in Wilayat Raqqa, talking to residents of Raqqa about the gold dinar and how they expressed their positive feelings towards it, and urging different traders and business people to switch to the new currency. Then a couple of days later in Wilayat Halab, they put out a video where groups of people are shown watching an Islamic State film about the minting of the new gold dinar locally. On the same day, they also put something out in Wilayat Nineveh, again showing people in the area talking about the gold dinar and commenting about its merits. A couple of days later, on September 10th, in Wilayat Al-Fallujah, they interviewed some residents in the garrison towns in the outskirts of the Islamic State's territory in Iraq. And one of the Islamic State officials was comparing the gold currency issued by Abdulmalik Marwan in the early Islamic period when he replaced it with the Persian and Roman coins, similarly now to what the dinar will do to replace the dollar and the euro. A day later, on September 11th, the Islamic State put out a video related to this in Wilayat al-Janub, where they're interviewing people that were describing the joy of the return of the dinar. On the same day, they put out another one from Wilayat Dijla, where interviewers were expressing positive views about the return of the gold dinar. Also on September 11th, in Wilayat Shabwa in Yemen, they talked to Islamic State fighters expressing their joy at how the gold dinar had returned. Also on September 11th in Wilayat Dijla again, they talked to some individuals in the territory describing how the return of the dinar is the beginning of the establishment of a solid Islamic currency. Then 2 days later, on September 13th, in Wilayat al-Barakah in northeastern Syria, again, they're talking to individuals about the return of the dinar and how excited they were related to it. And then finally, last one related to this was also on the 13th in Wilayat Kirkuk, where again they're discussing the gold dinar with a bunch of residents there and how it was a stable currency that would be very effective in destroying the dollar.
And once the refugees fleeing Syria and Iraq became a major story over the past month or so, with large numbers of them going to Europe, the Islamic State released a number of videos addressing this. Can you tell us about those releases?
Yeah, so after, you know, there's all those videos and pictures of individuals drowning and becoming a huge story that There is a huge wave of Syrian refugees going into different European countries. The Islamic State wanted to sort of take advantage of this by putting out a bunch of different releases. So between September 16th and 19th, they put out 12 different videos related to the refugee issue. So on the 16th, the first one was from Wilayat Salah ad-Din in Iraq. They're talking about the issue of those leaving the Islamic State for the land of the infidels. An Islamic State speaker explains how it is correct for Muslims to leave the land of the infidels for the land of Islam, but not vice versa, and that they'd only will find happiness in the land of the caliphate. On the same day in Wilayat al-Junub in Iraq, there's another video highlighting how Muslims cannot live in non-Muslim lands or seek refuge in infidel lands, and that such people can be considered to have abandoned their religion. In essence, they're saying that they're giving takfir on these individuals. On the 16th as well, there's a video from Wilayat al-Khair, the Deir ez-Zor region of Syria. And in it, a speaker discusses how Muslims should not mix or fraternize with infidels. And various members of the public are shown expressing their surprise at those who leave for Europe within their territory. And the video suggests they'll be forced to convert to Christianity in exchange for money or citizenship. And that those who leave will be forfeiting their rewards in paradise. On the same day as well, in Wilayat Hadramaut in Yemen, Islamic State put out a video where a speaker addresses the fleeing individuals to Europe, and he asks Muslims to imagine what their lives would be like if they went to Europe, exposing themselves to the dangers of drowning and people smugglers, but also if they arrived in Europe being subject to alleged injustice and outrage there. A day later, on the 17th, in Wilayat Homs, another video came out highlighting the imperative to remain within the lands of Islam, and the person that they interviewed talks about the threat of conversion and describes how the Islamic State has cared for refugees from Syrian regime territory, and therefore people should come to them. Also on the 17th, from Wilayat al-Furat, a province that spans both the Syrian and Iraqi borders, the video highlights that it's not legitimate migration, as it involves Muslims traveling to the land of the unbelievers, which are subject to human laws rather than the Sharia. And then they argue that Europe is accepting Muslim refugees as a tactic to increase the Shia, Druze, and Christian population of Syria and thus defeat the Islamic State. On the 17th as well, in Wilayat al-Fallujah in Iraq, in the video, they show news clips of refugees being beaten and chased by police after they arrive, most likely from Hungary, as I'm sure many people saw about a month or so ago, and then arguing that Muslims can only know true happiness and dignity in Muslim countries. On the 17th as well, in Wilayat al-Barakah in northeastern Syria, they put out another video arguing that, you know, what's happening only serves the interests of those trying to weaken Islam and forcing Muslims to work for the interests of, you know, the European countries and not for the good of Muslims. The next day on the 18th, there was one from Wilayat Halab in Syria. And this one showed a montage of clips, including a shot of Aylan Kurdi, the kid who, you know, infamously drown, and there's the picture of him with his head down on the beach. In the video, besides this, they then also show a montage in which scenes glorifying those who are migrating to the Islamic State, aka foreign fighters, juxtaposed with scenes showing refugees being mistreated in Europe. Also on the 18th, Wilayat al-Raqqa, the main argument in this video is essentially arguing that once Muslims get to Europe, their children will abandon Islam. Also on the 18th in Wilayat al-Jazira, which spans the Syrian-Iraqi borders, there's an interview with refugees who fled the Peshmerga and have found refuge in the Islamic State, where they say they've been welcomed and are living a good life with no problems. The next day on the 19th, and the last video in this large series, there's a video from Wilayat Dijla in Iraq, and it discusses how the rate of those migrating to the Islamic State far outstrips those leaving, sort of arguing in some sense that they're getting more foreign fighters, or muhajirin as they call them, than people really leaving their territory. Obviously, it's nearly impossible to verify that. But for anybody that follows what's going on in Syria, it is true that many of these individuals that are leaving are refugees from areas where the Assad regime was controlling, or people that just had enough of the refugee camps in Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey and wanted to go for a better life. So, you know, it's definitely possible that they could be correct, but there could be other factors related to it, as well as the fact that, you know, as anybody that follows this closely knows, the Islamic State is tight control in their territory, and therefore it's very difficult for anybody to flee there.
In the middle of August, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula released a video on the recent events in Yemen. Can you tell us a little bit about what that video contained?
So yeah, on August 15th, AQAP's Jalal Buladi al-Markishi, or Hamza al-Zinjibari, put out a video message with a number of different ideas related to what had been recently happening in Yemen at the time. The most significant that he was talking about was emphasizing that AQAP's fight is the people's fight and not that of any particular group, likely alluding to sort of the supremacist nature of how the Islamic State operates. And in the video, the person that's interviewing him asks him about the recent decline in the number of suicide attacks in Yemen. And al-Markishi replies that there have been some, but that they're governed by certain conditions and that suicide bombing should only be the last resort. And you have to make sure no Muslims will be harmed. Again, highlighting sort of the rules of engagement that Al-Qaeda and their branches are now following through on since Ayman al-Zawahiri put out his guidelines in September 2013.
And can you tell us about releases from Jabhat al-Nusra during the end of August, beginning of September time period?
Yeah, so on August 30th, Jabhat al-Nusra's top Sharia official, Dr. Sami al-Uraidi, discussed the issue of working with infidels and what and how it would be wise or unwise depending on a particular situation. And he's arguing that people either get bogged down in theory without considering the real situation on the ground, or they talk about it speculatively without bothering with Sharia theory at all. And then he highlights that there's a difference between asking for help from infidels and then directly compared with directly supporting them, saying that the first is permissible, especially when it involves repelling an aggressor, whereas the second is not permissible at all. And then a couple of days later, on September 3rd, another important senior leader in Jabhat al-Nusra, Sheikh Abu Abdullah al-Shami, put out an essay in response to statements that were made by David Petraeus at the time. I'm sure people recall how Petraeus was discussing peeling off potential moderate elements within Jabhat al-Nusra to sort of maybe recreate the Sahwa in Iraq last decade in the Syrian case to then fight against the Islamic State. But in this article that al-Shami put out, he said that the American definition of moderate is someone whom Jabhat al-Nusra would define as a traitor to their religion, and therefore criticizes Petraeus' comments for implying that JN or Jabhat al-Nusra is made up of competing factions. And then highlighting that enmity against the group which has fallen into bid'ah or innovation yet remains within Islam, and enmity between the faith and the infidel are different, and that you know, the latter is obviously a lot worse since it's related to non-Muslims at all. And he concludes by saying that you know, they refuse to accept that the Islamic State's a common enemy for them and America, or that they have common cause with the Americans in any way at all.
And during the mid to end of August, early September time period, we're looking at, there have been a couple releases of note from jihadi ideologues. Can you tell us what those releases covered?
So there is one on August 15th from Abu Walid al-Masri, and this was mainly about the Taliban. And for those who recall, this was sort of right after the controversy related to Mullah Omar's death and the fact that it was covered up for essentially 2 years. And he was highlighting the geopolitical significance of Afghanistan and how it faces alleged interferences by India and Pakistan as well as Western powers, and describes the Islamic State and other jihadi groups as aspects of the chaos supposedly manufactured by the United States and its allies. But in contrast to this, Al-Masri notes that the Taliban has been able to secure and bring security and stability to Afghanistan, having maintained its territorial integrity. But he argues that in the aftermath of Mullah Omar's death, that the decisions of the new leadership will be under close scrutiny in light of the fact that it was acknowledged that they held his death for 2 years, and therefore they needed to be very wise about what they're up to. And the other key release from an important ideologue happened on September 4th from Sheikh Abu Mundhir al-Shankiti. And this was in response to the issue of or the sanctity of burning an individual, in particular related to the Islamic State's fatwa on the permissibility of burning infidels to death. And of course, this is in relation to when the Islamic State burned the Jordanian pilot alive this past January. And Shankiti takes issue with the way in which IS has interpreted the sources used in their fatwa, for example, claiming that the Shafi and the Hanafi legal schools permit burning infidels in all cases. And he says that IS's guidance is misleading and wrong, and that the scholarship and writing style of the fatwa is substandard. And then he proceeds to cite a number of hadith in which the Muslim prophet Muhammad forbade burning enemies. And then he concludes by noting that one argument advanced is that some of the companions of Muhammad practiced burning, but this is not a valid argument according to Shankiti, because it does not supersede the textual evidence or the example of Muhammad himself.
And turning to North Africa, can you tell us about the brochure that Ansar al-Sharia in Libya released in early September?
Yeah, on September 8th, ASL put out a message to the people of Benghazi. They wanted to correct some suspicions about them, likely due to rumors that had swirled locally. And the first one is sort of rhetorically asking why Ansar al-Sharia fights, and they respond, not for the glory or personal gain, but for the religion and for Sharia. And the second question relates to what will come of them after the fighting, and Ansar al-Sharia reassures the population of Benghazi that they'll strive to establish God's religion. The third question relates to whether Ansar al-Sharia are Kharijites, and firmly the answer that they're not, and that they're attempting to distinguish themselves from the Islamic State, whom they view as Kharijites since they shed innocent Muslim blood. And the final question in this brochure deals with whether the group will bring security to Benghazi, and Ansar al-Sharia argue that they will do so by applying Sharia.
And in September, Al-Qaeda put out a couple releases from Dr. Z. Can you tell us what he talked about in those lectures?
Yeah, so in early to mid-September, we started to see a flurry of new releases again from Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. And some of them were a series that Ayman al-Zawahiri started to put out. And in the time frame that we look at, he put out the first two within the Islamic Spring series. On September 9th, the video first gives condolences for the recent deaths of several AQ-affiliated leaders and thanks the leaders such as Nasr al-Wahashi in Yemen. Then he argues that the Islamic State has left al-Qaeda no choice, even though they believe in reconciliation and cooperation between the Mujahideen. I mean, he argues that al-Baghdadi's only concern has been to create divisions between the Mujahideen. And he restates that al-Qaeda does not recognize the caliphate and that Muslims are not obligated to pledge bay'ah to him. Then a couple of days later, on September 12th, the second part in the Islamic Spring series came out, and he highlighted how the Arab Spring showed how secular nationalism failed. Then he goes into various Islamic resistant movements over the years and the reasons for the collapse of the caliphate in 1924 before concluding that a return of the caliphate is desirable, but not a caliphate that is imposed without any consultation, obviously a direct dig at the Islamic State. And then since then, he's put out four other videos, but those were after September 19th. So I'll talk more about those in the next podcast.
And finally, in the beginning of September, Jaysh Al-Fateh released a video. Can you tell us what that contained?
Yeah, on September 8th, Jaysh Al-Fateh, which is sort of an umbrella military group in Syria, it's mainly Ahrar al-Sham and Jabhat al-Nusra, as well as some other smaller factions together put out this video about how Idlib city was being managed and what their alleged achievements were making under their nascent administration after they liberated the city itself, as well as the broader governorate of Idlib. And essentially arguing and highlighting that, you know, after they took over, they're drawing on the expertise of the local inhabitants there, that they weren't trying to reinvent the wheel, essentially, and that the council took charge of securing the water and electricity supplies and of ensuring that all granaries and bakeries were operating, and that they're establishing administration for larger entities such as healthcare and education, including the reopening of Idlib University. And they conclude by talking about the longer-term plans that they hope for in terms of, you know, bringing back the agricultural industry, as well as helping rebuild infrastructure in Idlib as well.
All right. Well, that finishes up the primary sources info for this episode. We'll have a lot more on the next episode. But for now, here's Aaron's conversation with Will McCants.
For those that follow my work, I'm sure it's quite obvious that the issue of jihadi governance is an interest to me, which is why when I read the chapter in Will's new book, The ISIS Apocalypse, The History, Strategy, and Doomsday Vision of the Islamic State, that provided a brief overview of it to better contextualize the rise of the Islamic State, I thought it was the best overarching treatment of the topic thus far. So today I have Will on the show to talk a little bit more about this. Thanks for coming onto the show today, Will.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
So as background, while the Islamic State has been a lot more advanced, sophisticated, and actually controlling a large swath of territory now, this is not their first rodeo in attempting to act like a state. Back in 2006, it announced the Islamic State of Iraq, or ISI. Will, can you take us through the process of ISI attempting to build a state a decade ago? What did they do, and what did it look like?
Sure. I mean, what's fascinating about the early Islamic State is, even though it proclaimed itself to be a state, it didn't really control any territory. Its predecessor organization, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, had actually controlled a few towns once in a while. But by the time the Islamic State proclaimed itself in October 2006, it didn't really control anything. But it said it was a state, which proved laughable for a number of people in the jihadist movement. Aaron, I think you'll remember at that time there were several jihadist heavy hitters who were writing very sharp critiques of the Islamic State because they felt the Islamic State lacked that one teeny tiny essential ingredient to being a state, which was controlling actual land. So the Islamic State put out a statement in 2007 explaining how it should be treated as a state. And in there, they sort of lay out their political strategy and vision for what a state looks like. And the duties they enumerated were the usual duties that a state is supposed to take care of: security, raising taxes, providing for the public good, so on and so forth. What's interesting is that the Islamic State didn't really qualify on any of those grounds. The one thing perhaps they could claim was that they were trying to impose the fixed punishments mentioned in Islamic scripture, the so-called hudud. But again, it was sporadic. And so by its own criteria then, it couldn't really be considered a state in its early history. But what's fascinating, and I document in the chapter you're talking about, is how at the time of the Islamic State's defeat in 2008-2009, when it was pushed back underground to become a clandestine terror group again, the idea that it had put around, that it was the state, the early Islamic State reconstituted, caught on with Al-Qaeda's other affiliates.
Yeah, that definitely is the case, as we saw in the years after that. So even though this sort of first state of the Islamic State failed, what would you say were the key takeaways or lessons learned from both the Islamic State of Iraq as well as Al-Qaeda from this experience?
Right. So from Al-Qaeda Central's perspective, so we're talking bin Laden, Zawahiri, this thing had been a horrible, tragic mistake. They had wanted to see a state established in Iraq, but they wanted it to happen after the Americans were gone and after the jihadists had built a broad coalition. They felt establishing the state before that time would have been premature. And so they saw the Islamic State's demise in 2009 as a fulfillment of their own prophecy of what would happen. And bin Laden in particular, in several later letters, enumerated several mistakes the Islamic State made, one of which he honed in on was their inability to work with the Sunni Arab tribes, particularly in Anbar, and that the Islamic State had made the mistake of initiating blood feuds with the tribes because the Islamic State was trying to discourage them from working with the United States, but they had touched off this cycle of blood feuds that proved to be incredibly damaging to the organization. So bin Laden had been hesitant about state building in the Middle East, and the experience in Iraq made him even more hesitant and more certain that Al-Qaeda should be focusing its effort on getting the West out of the Middle East before it really tried to do state building. From the Islamic State's perspective, they felt also that they had not done well enough in working with the tribes. But their solution was not to ditch the state building project. It was just to figure out a way to work with the tribes better. And there's one document I bring up later in the book written by some people in the Islamic State orbit. And it reads like a think tank report, a Washington, D.C. style report. And it goes through lessons learned and what can be done better so the Islamic State can make a comeback. And one of the things that they really hone in on is the need to work with the tribes. And their model for how to do this right the second time around was not the Prophet's example in early Islam, but it was what the Americans had done in Anbar province. And they really took to this idea of building popular committees, local militias, and buying off tribes when they could, subjugating them when they wouldn't play ball, but they looked to the Americans as the ones who had shown the way. And I think you can say to some degree they've followed that advice since then.
Yeah, definitely. So before we get to what's been going on more recently, I think it's good to sort of look at what happened between then with the different Al-Qaeda branches that then attempted governance as well. So the first group that sort of did this was Harakat al-Shabaab al-Mujahideen in Somalia. Could you maybe talk a little bit about their experience when they were, in control of I guess they still are in control of territory, but sort of the height of it around 2007 through 2009 or so?
Right. So they controlled a large amount of territory in Somalia, which is a pretty big country to begin with. And by 2009, they were debating about whether they should proclaim themselves an emirate. They were also debating whether they should join Al-Qaeda. It's interesting, and something I document in that chapter, is that every time one of these Al-Qaeda-linked groups got interested in state building, you could tell they were getting interested because they began to fly the Islamic State's flag. And it's not that they were joining the Islamic State, but they liked the idea that the flag represented. So the Shabaab put the question to bin Laden, number one, can we join your organization? Number two, can we declare ourselves a state? And bin Laden dragged his feet. There's a funny exchange between bin Laden and his chief of staff, and the chief of staff is saying, come on, dude, make up your mind. They've been waiting for a while. Bin Laden finally makes up his mind, and on the question of whether they can join Al-Qaeda, he says basically they can join, but they have to be a private affiliate. They can't go public yet with their affiliation because he didn't want added heat brought down on them by virtue of joining Al-Qaeda. On the question of whether they can declare themselves an emirate, it's interesting. He says that, you control enough territory to be considered an emirate, but I don't think you have enough resources to actually govern this thing. And you don't want to proclaim yourself to be a state and then not deliver on it. And we will see this as a theme throughout his advice to a number of the affiliates. Don't do this unless you can actually make good on it. And he said you don't have enough judges to administer the territories. And even if you do this, bin Laden also counsels the Shabab to be lenient in how they govern. He says many of these people who are living under your rule are not used to living under the strict code of the Salafi interpretation of Islamic law. And you have to go it slow. You have to be mindful that they aren't quite ready to fully implement these fixed punishments mentioned in Islamic scripture. So the cutting of the hand for theft and the harsh punishment for drinking alcohol, so on and so forth. It's not advice that the Shabab really listened to, but nevertheless, you could see where bin Laden's head was always on this stuff. Very tentative about state building, wanting to make sure the capacity there was first, but also his general feeling that this move to establish states was in some ways premature given the range of global enemies that were arrayed against the jihadists.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the reasons that the project in Somalia really fell apart was when there's the drought that turned into a famine in Somalia. And that's when many people started to go against Shabab and they started to lose territory. And while they still hold on to some territory, it's nowhere near what it was like 5 years or so ago. So moving a little bit to the east of Somalia, after the Arab uprisings in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP, took over some territory in southern Yemen and started to govern themselves. Part of it was through their front group named Ansar al-Sharia. Can you maybe talk a little bit about this case from 2011-2012 time period?
Yeah, so here's another instance of an affiliate going their own way. When bin Laden had asked AQAP specifically not to engage in state building, not to really pick a fight with the Yemeni government, to stay focused on the United States, the local affiliate looked around and saw opportunity. It saw that the Yemeni government's hold on power was weakening even further. It was already a pretty decentralized state. And they saw the time is ripe to try and govern. They went about things in a bit of a different way than the Shabab, though. The Shabab had been pretty harsh by comparison. AQAP was still harsh, but there were instances of them being milder. I think there were several towns they controlled where they didn't get too worked up, for example, about smoking cigarettes, which the Shabab could get really worked up about. And they, more importantly, began to advertise that they were engaged in good governance. So they had their media arm begin to put out videos of inhabitants in newly liberated areas. And the inhabitants would issue glowing statements about electricity being turned on and the water working, and isn't this great, and the government's never helped us out in this way. Who knows if they were sincere or not? It's hard to know when somebody's got both a gun and a camera pointed in your face. But the fact of the matter is, AQAP believed that it was important to demonstrate to the inhabitants of Yemen and to the global Muslim community that they were serious about state building. And despite bin Laden's strong warning against doing it, they went ahead with it. And what's fascinating, I believe this is in bin Laden's letter to AQAP, he has an insight, I think, that is really important. And that is, he says, one of the reasons you don't want to try and govern a state yet is because Arabs have an outsized expectation of what the state can do. Either because they live in oil-rich states or they live in socialist influenced states where the state does everything. Arabs think that government should be providing all sorts of services from cradle to the grave. And because they have these outsized expectations, if you jihadists take over and begin running your own state and you're not able to live up to these outside expectations, they're going to quickly turn on you. The AQAP project fails. And it's interesting. There's a little bit of a, we get a glimpse of an internal discussion about, you know, why they have failed. They don't quite cop to it being because there was bad governance. They point to the more immediate and obvious reason for their failure, which was a powerful foreign nation working with the local government, and local tribes ousted them from the areas that they held.
Yeah. Only a little time after that, then in 2012, we saw AQIM take over northern Mali along with some of their local allies. As we know, the now dead leader of AQAP, Nasser al-Wahashi, actually sent some advice and lessons learned from AQAP's experience to AQIM's leader, Abu Musab al-Abdul-Dud. What were these, what was this information he sent them? And then how did AQIM actually govern the territory when they controlled it before the French intervention?
Right. So here's a fascinating case of the experience of one al-Qaeda affiliate directly impacting at least the leadership of another affiliate. The head of AQAP, Wahashi, writes a letter to the head of AQIM, Abdul Wadud, and advises him on how to govern properly based on AQAP's lessons. And he basically repeats bin Laden's advice to go it slow, to try and build a broad-based coalition, to implement the Hudud punishments very slowly, so on and so forth. And Abdul Wadud seems to have either taken it to heart or already believed the same, because he writes a long letter to his commanders in Mali and advises them on how to govern properly. But by the time he writes the letter, it's a little bit too late. He's telling them, you know, be respectful of the lives of the citizens, be respectful of local religion, implement the Hudud slowly. But of course, his commanders and those they were working with on the ground had already gone ahead and abused the locals to such an extent that they were having a tough time keeping a lid on popular discontent. Wahashi also advises that AQIM and its fellow travelers are going to need a backup plan, because they are probably going to invite foreign invasion by virtue of the fact of being global jihadists. And he calls on the groups to not mention their al-Qaeda affiliation, to try and present themselves as a nationally oriented movement. He's not saying to break ties with al-Qaeda or to really adopt a more nationalist perspective, but he's saying we want to avoid foreign intervention at all costs, because this is what's going to destroy our enterprise. And I think that's an important insight, and one, you know, I had not really taken the full measure of. I think, Aaron, in the previous decade, a lot of us in the West and also al-Qaeda's leadership adopted this idea, embraced this idea that, you know, if you govern poorly, if you're too brutal, you are inevitably going to be overthrown and done away with. But the experience of these jihadist groups has actually been that the primary reason for failure was not poor governance. It was that they had made too many powerful enemies outside of the territory that they govern, and that ultimately caused their demise.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And from this, all these experiences of AQ's branches over the previous years, we then started to see sort of, I'd argue, their most mature and strategic example of this with Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria over the past 2 to 3 years. How would you say they have done things differently, and how are they governing or controlling the areas in Idlib and parts of northern Syria that they're operating in now?
Right. So you have a great experiment running in Syria and Iraq. I mean, it comes at a horrible human cost. But if you are a jihadist and you want to see which model works best, is it the Islamic State's brutal way of doing things? Or is it more of the classical Al-Qaeda central perspective of a hearts and minds approach? You could say that the Islamic State at the moment has proven to have the right of it, that the brutal approach is far better because they've got more to show for it. They actually control a lot of territory, and they are the undisputed power in that territory, even though they worked with others in the early days. Nusra has adopted a different approach, and this is one reason why it came to blows with the Islamic State. Nusra was following the bin Laden and Zawahiri advice to work with the other insurgent groups, to present themselves as the protector of the people, to not set themselves up as a state over everyone else, and to focus much more on winning over popular support among Muslims. You could say from Nusra's perspective, they have also been a great success. They have controlled a decent amount of territory at any given time, and they are also seen as an essential part of the insurgency inside of Syria, which is no mean feat, given the countries arrayed against them, including the United States. And I suppose from Nusra's perspective, they would argue that in the long term, their approach will pay off more. But of course, the bottom line is, do either of these approaches, the Islamic State approach or the Nusra approach, lead to the establishment of a durable Islamic State? And the point I make in the book is that they never get to find out, because by virtue of being global jihadists, by always threatening outside powers, whether they mean it or not, they invite foreign intervention and ultimately, if not destruction, then failure for their state-building program.
Yeah, and while the Islamic State obviously doesn't have the same level of popularity or is not embedded within the mainstream rebellion or insurgency, and doesn't really have much of any legitimacy from anyone except for themselves, they seem to have carved out their own territory for now within two states, or what used to be two states. So finally, with the case of the Islamic State, what have they done differently this time from, say, 2004 to 2009 time period? And why have they been so much more successful now, you think?
Well, you'd have to say a big reason is the change in the political realities on the ground. I mean, in the previous decade, they overreached and angered the Sunni Arab tribes that they proposed to govern. And those tribes were instrumental in throwing them off. But it also mattered that a large foreign force was occupying that territory at the time as well, namely the United States. And those tribes had someone to turn to. Today, that military is gone, and the Islamic State has not really faced a serious state rival in the area where it's trying to do its state building. And even if Sunni Arabs living under its rule are unhappy with it, they've really got nowhere to turn. But many of them are also very disenfranchised and disgruntled with the governments in Damascus and Baghdad. So the Islamic State has benefited in that way as well. Some of those tribes have done a deal with the devil. because they were so angry about being cut out of power. But, you know, a number of different groups could have benefited from the same dynamics as well. And I think, to me, this is where ideology and strategy also comes into play, right? So there's an array of jihadist groups who benefit from these things too. Why is it the Islamic State came out on top? Well, you would have to say one is its focus on state building. The fact that it wanted to create its own government in the Sunni hinterland rather than overthrowing an existing government in Damascus or Baghdad meant that those governments, particularly in Syria, were more focused on the rebels who presented an immediate threat to them rather than the Yahoos trying to do state building off in the far countryside. So their focus on state building, which had been such a liability the first time around, ends up being a huge benefit this time around because of the neglect of these central governments in the countries that surrounded the area where the Islamic State was doing state building. It's also its brutal methods proved to be much more effective in the short term than the kind of broad-based coalition that Nusra and some of the other jihadist groups were trying to build. You know, when you build coalitions and you govern towns in concert with these other groups, it is hard to make decisions. Therefore, the provision of goods, the dispensing of justice can end up being confused and inefficient. Whereas the Islamic State brutally set up its own governments, pushed out any rivals, and quickly had a monopoly on violence. And, you know, it's not the kind of regime that a lot of its inhabitants are happy about living under, but at least it functions, and they've been able to establish a state. So this brutal method of insurgency, contra the hearts and minds approach that bin Laden wanted, has proven to be much more effective, at least in the short term, in state building and governing.
Yeah, it's definitely something to continue to look out for in the future. So thanks for coming onto the show today, Will, and taking us through a brief history of jihadi governments. It will no doubt continue to be a relevant topic with what's going on in Syria, the Islamic State's attempt to export this model elsewhere, and it seems AQAP now once again controlling some parts of territory in Yemen. And for more on jihadi governance and chock full of other great information, pick up Will's new book, The ISIS Apocalypse, The History, Strategy, and Doomsday Vision of the Islamic State.
Thank you, man.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover posts from October 7th through the 13th.
During that time period, 5 foreign fighters were officially announced killed in Iraq with the Islamic State, while also during that time, 4 military operations were announced by AQAP.
On October 7th, Wilayat al-Farat of the Islamic State provided polio vaccinations to children.
On the 7th as well, Wilayat al-Barakah of the Islamic State posted signs warning against using new currency issued by the Assad regime.
Also on the 7th, Wilayat al-Anbar of the Islamic State shows off its animal feed production industry.
On October 7th as well, Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen Darna returned stolen equipment to the University of Darna that the Islamic State took when it was control of part of the city in Libya.
On October 10th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State's Diwan al-Zakat creates ID cards for the poor and needy.
Also on the 10th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State fixes potholes on the road between Tal Afar and Mosul.
Also on October 10th, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula executed 4 alleged sorcerers.
On October 11th, Jabhat al-Nusra cleans roads and makes a new sign for the entrance to Abu Zuhur Military Airport.
On October 12th, Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen Darna sets up a complaints office.
On October 13th, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State gains new bayah from Abu Hamad clan in Iraq.
And on October 13th as well, Wilayat Hama of the Islamic State shows off the barley harvest in the village of Khalid Hilal, Syria. If you have any feedback, you can email us, podcast@jihadology.net, or find us on Twitter, where we are @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the show, please consider visiting the Patreon link in the show notes and helping us out with a small donation, which will help cover the costs of hosting and equipment and the time that it takes to produce the podcast. Also, the show is available on Stitcher as well as iTunes, and if you enjoy it, please consider taking a moment to rate and review the podcast, which will help more people find the program.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks to Will for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster Carl Moran for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. And finally, to Elsbeth Carruthers for helping with background research on the primary source material. Until next time, I'm out.